I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, returns from his overseas trip to a situation in Ukraine crisis that has changed, not profoundly, but at this point you'd say both sides are stomping around as the winter ends and the spring begins. What we have in front of us is Minsk II. That was a resolution, so-called, in the depths of winter that stopped the fighting on the Donbass front. Right now, there's good reason to celebrate Minsk II because the major weapons have been pulled back, we're told, acceptably by both sides, so that there's no more firing upon Donetsk or the Donetsk airport, no more Grad fire into Mariupol on the coastline. However, off stage, the players are gathering with doubts. One, of course, is the Nemtsov murder, the murder of a man who was associated with the opposition to Vladimir Putin these many years, a former member of government. The Russian Secret Service says that it's arrested or pointed to accusations against five ethnic Chechens. Some are under arrest, and that investigation goes forward with many doubts in the West. But focusing on Ukraine crisis, before I welcome the professor back, we have statements by, for example, the head of NATO, General Breedlove, saying that the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, had, quote, upped the ante in eastern Ukraine. Quote, what is clear is that right now it is not getting better. It is getting worse every day, said General Breedlove. He added, it is my responsibility as the commander of NATO's military forces to deliver clear assessments regarding potential threats in our periphery. That was regarded as bellicose in Germany, and there was a flap. We also had news that at the beginning of February, before Minsk II, the esteemed Polish American Brzezinski, who served as a national security advisor and is now seen as a senior member of the foreign policy graybeards of the United States, had this quote before Congress. I wonder how many people in this room or this very important senatorial committee really anticipated that one day Putin would land military personnel in Crimea and seize it. I think if anybody said that's what he's going to do, he or she would have been labeled as a warmonger. He did it, and he got away with it. I think he's also drawing lessons from that, and I'll tell you what my horror night dream is. That one day, I literally mean one day, he seizes Riga and Tallinn, Latvia and Estonia. It would literally take him one day. There is no way they could resist. And then we will say, how horrible, how shocking, how outrageous. But of course, we can't do anything about it. It's happened. We aren't going to assemble a fleet in the Baltic and then engage in amphibious landings and then storm ashore like in Normandy to take it back. We have to respond in some larger fashion, perhaps, but then there will be voices that this will plunge us into nuclear war. I'll end there with the headlines to welcome the professor back. The war footing, Steve, is now commonplace conversation in Washington while we await the springtime in Ukraine. Good evening to you.
Kind of wish I hadn't come back because these things, like Brzezinski's saying and Breedlove's saying, are based on nothing except their political, ideological imaginations. There's no intelligence to support this. Breedlove is a prominent member of the war party. He's the head of NATO. NATO has no intelligence forces of its own. He gets his information from social media. Neither NATO nor the United States have ever produced any hard intelligence to back up the claims that there's been this massive Russian invasion. John, you and I are old enough to know what a Russian invasion looks like.
Yes.
Columns of tanks roll across the border. Armored personnel carriers roll across the border.
Yes, and they take the airports.
They shut down the airports. They shut down the communication of that country. Paratroopers drop behind the lines from the sky. You know, what's going on, I think this is what it's about, all of it. And even the murder of Nemtsov may be about that, I'm not sure. But that we've come to this fork in the road. Just before I left, about 10 days ago, Chancellor Merkel of Germany and President Hollande of France brokered with Putin and the President of Ukraine what's being called Minsk II, because it took place in Minsk, called for a ceasefire, called for withdrawal of heavy artillery on both sides, called for the end of the killing, called for negotiations between Kiev and the political leadership of the rebel territories and called for Kiev to enact constitution by the end of the year that would give a considerable amount of home rule to these rebellious eastern provinces, and that when that happened, if it happened, Kiev would be given back control of the Russian-Ukrainian border. Now, this was a kind of grand plan to solve this crisis, or at least to end the killing. But very powerful forces in different capitals do not want this to happen. And one of the things we've seen in the last week is an extraordinary escalation of warfare rhetoric with, I hate to say this, but it's true, American disinformation. One of the leading members of the State Department goes to Congress, Victoria Nuland, and says that the Russians have increased their invasion and that the Russians are carrying out a reign of terror in eastern Ukraine. One would have thought it was Kiev, which has been bombing those provinces since April, that had carried out the reign of terror. Breedlove claims he sees the situation getting worse militarily. So I see this, this rhetoric, as the spokespeople of the anti-Minsk factions, which include people like Senator McCain in the Congress, members of Obama's own administration, spokespeople from NATO and the others, trying to undermine what Merkel achieved. Now, the odd thing is, Obama appears to have told Merkel, and this seems to have been confirmed by a German diplomat today or yesterday, that he would not ship those weapons that he's been authorized to ship to Kiev until he sees if Merkel's diplomatic overture initiative works out. But now you have members of Obama's own party attacking him for doing nothing. So it's now all-out rhetorical war, and it's all focused on the question of whether Minsk II, which is diplomacy and ceasefire, is going to prevail, or whether there's going to be an escalation of the war, and if there is, I think a real chance of war with Russia. That's where we stand now. And I have to say that in my lifetime, I do not remember, well, I guess maybe early on in Vietnam, early on in the Iraq War, but so many very credible, normally credible people and officials saying so many things that are either untrue or cannot be proved. It appears that this is kind of a desperate struggle over American policy toward Russia and Ukraine.
I'm struck, Steve, how the language by the war party, so-called, no longer involves sanctions. Remember during December and January, sanctions were much in the news. We'll increase the sanctions and Putin will bow down to common sense and he'll see his best path forward is to agree with us and return Crimea to Ukraine and acknowledge the sovereignty of the state. That's gone away now. Instead, we're hearing war game talk or war scenario talk. I mentioned, for example, and this looks like a blow to anyone who thinks that this is going to be over soon. Russia said March 10th it would no longer participate in a consulting group on the Treaty on Conventional Armed Forces in Europe. This means that Russia has ended its participation since the 1990 Security Treaty. Russia announced in 2007 that it intended to pull out of the treaty, and now it's gone. And, Steve, the fact that this treaty is part of the ending of the Cold War, I think it endorses the whole theory that Russia's ready to go back to it, go back at it. It's not looking to resolve Ukraine. It's looking to face the Americans or face NATO as they did back in the 20th century.
Well, as Putin said back in, I guess it was March, the West has driven us into a corner. Mm. There's nowhere for us to retreat to. Therefore, we now make our stand. Now, if you parse that statement, Putin and the Russian political class feel that we have initiated this confrontation, and they are not going to retreat. And that's very dangerous. You make a good point about this conventional weapons treaty. If we think back about what was achieved by Gorbachev, President Reagan, and the first President Bush between 1987 and 1990-91, the two great achievements in terms of making the world safer were the Conventional Forces Treaty, which meant that the two sides would agree where and how much of their conventional forces would be located, and none would do anything that was menacing to the other side, stabilize security arrangements. And the second achievement, and it was the first time any nuclear weapons had ever been abolished, a whole class, was when Reagan and Gorbachev abolished intermediate-range nuclear missiles. Remember, we had those Pershing missiles in Europe that could reach Russia in 13 minutes. They were very destabilizing. Russia had its missiles pointed toward Europe. They were abolished. I mean, not just pulled back, but destroyed. Now both sides are rebuilding them. So we're back in a Cold War, but something has happened that's even worse, that we're shredding decades of cooperative and security-building agreements that were made with the Soviet Union and with post-Soviet Russia. They're all being shredded
as a result
of the Ukrainian crisis. So we are in a Cold War, and I think it's even more risky because there's no rules.
The professor is just back from Europe, Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian history. And when we come back, I'm going to ask him what he heard on the continent, especially in Germany, because if there is a way out of this, it's the arbiters that are between Moscow and Washington. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian history emeritus, has returned from his overseas travels. And on the Donbass front, much has not changed. However, the rhetoric of conflict, Cold War conflict between NATO and Moscow, is now commonplace, especially from the American side of the story. For example, General Breedlove, commanding NATO forces in Europe, comments on the Crimea, saying what we've seen is easy to describe as the militarization of Crimea. They brought an air capability, meaning the Russians. They've increased their capability to project sea power from there. We see very capable surface-to-air defense systems that range about 40% of the Black Sea. And we've seen very sophisticated missile defense systems that range almost the entire Black Sea. The general went on to make other remarks to the effect that Ukraine is now a war camp preparing for a military conflict. Steve, I ask you, on the continent itself, especially in Germany, Have they a way forward for us that is neither Moscow nor Washington? Is there a third avenue?
If we take what Merkel and Hollande did in Minsk, that is to broker a diplomatic solution, and then we look at the European countries that have supported the Merkel-Hollande agreement they reached with Putin, and that's Spain, Greece, Italy, France, Germany, of course, Hungary, even some of the countries that were in the Soviet bloc. I don't think you can say that Europe is playing the role of mediator any longer. These countries of Europe, and Germany and France in particular, have given up on American leadership. Merkel concluded, and evidently Hollande and other European leaders as well, that American leadership in the Ukrainian crisis had become dangerous and was running the risk of war, and so they took matters in their own hands. I don't think there's any dispute about that. There's only two questions. Will they prevail, or will the war party in NATO, in Brussels, and in Washington defeat that diplomatic overture? And secondly, is that split with American leadership of the transatlantic alliance likely to become a permanent split? Or to put it differently, we will never again entrust the leadership, the political leadership of our security, to Washington. Because Europe feels, and this really isn't fair because Europe went along for too long, but many countries of Europe feel they were dragged into this crisis by the United States, which had a kind of vendetta with Putin that they didn't want for economic, political, military, or any other reason. So at the moment, Europe has taken the lead. Historically, looking down the road, we may be seeing, I don't want to overstate this, but a kind of end or diminishing of the transatlantic alliance that's been in place since the end of World War II.
The Germans know they have money to lose or to make here. that drives a lot of really good decisions in history. You know, what's in it for me? Prosperity.
Yeah.
Do the Germans understand that this present standoff between NATO and Moscow is a loser? Do they see that clearly, or do they think there's a winner here?
Let me answer that question in a roundabout way. I am not an expert on European politics. I was in Brussels 2 days at the European Parliament, and I wasn't astonished, but seeing it and hearing it yourself emphasizes what a vital political debate they have in the European Parliament about the Ukrainian crisis, while we have none. Then I went to Germany with Professor John Mersheimer of the University of Chicago. We were the two Americans in a roundtable debate in front of 400 bankers. It was it was sponsored by a bank, and the subject was security in the Ukrainian crisis. The bankers themselves are divided, but here's what's interesting. I don't think any of them talked about the profits they were losing because of the sanctions. They were all talking about the possibility of war. We don't seem to perceive that in the United States, that we might be on the brink of war with Russia. German bankers understand that. Now, of course, their bottom line. But the bankers themselves are split on profits. Apparently about half of the European corporate banking community is heavily dependent on the Russian market, and they've suffered. The other half is not and don't really care about it. And some say Merkel's torn between the two of them. That's why she's been ziggy-zaggy and hesitant. But I would say one thing for sure, and partly because Europe has had a different history than America. Russia is their neighbor. They've shared Russia's history of dictatorship, war, occupation. That genetically, in their genes, they sense that the possibility of war is in the air. And they've concluded that it's been American policy as much as Russian policy that's led to this predicament, and they want it ended. We don't have that kind of political drive here. Instead, we have American senators from conservative to liberal, from John McCain of the Republican Party to Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut, of the so-called progressive wing of the Democratic Party, beating the war drum, wanting to ship weapons to Ukraine. I don't think it's very hard to find in Europe, outside the NATO command, anybody in Europe who thinks shipping weapons to Ukraine is a good idea.
Just a moment, Steve. When we come back, I'm going to lay out three scenarios for the war that will begin in Ukraine on the Crimea, the NATO war that will begin there in future. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University and Princeton University, Russian History. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is returned from traveling on the continent, listening to European voices converse about Ukraine crisis. Fog of diplomacy makes it very difficult to reach through what happened at Minsk II and say, is this going to lead to peace and stand down, or will this begin a new ground offensive by both sides come the spring? And that's now. Both sides are gathering their forces. They're staring at each other across a ceasefire line. The major weapon systems have been pulled back. However, NATO, led by General Breedlove and other voices, are talking about war with Russia, not war with Russia's supporters in Donbass and the Russian volunteers, but war with Russia. That would be along the Polish and Baltic frontiers. We're also told that the Russians are preparing the possibility of an offensive in Ukraine that will take the Crimea or secure the Black Sea coast. And I want to lay out three scenarios. This is from Stratfor.com within these last days, laid out as a Russian offensive. Russian offensive. You understand, this is the point of view of what will Moscow do that will preclude the President of the United States arming Kiev, or NATO coming in on the side of Kiev to press their advantage in the east of the country. Scenario number one is land bridge scenario. Therefore, from Donbass, which is the cities of Donetsk and Luhansk, the Russian forces drive past Mariupol all the way to Crimea and secure that part of the coastline for Russia. The second scenario is called coastal scenario. I'm following from Stratfor.com, but I note that this was picked up by the Moldovan Twitter feed, and so they're looking at this same thing in Moldova, which borders Ukraine. This one is called the coastal scenario. Same offensive, Mariupol, but they drive all the way to Odessa and dominate the whole Black Sea coastline. The third scenario is called the eastern Ukraine scenario, in which the Russian forces, this would be major military units, fan out not only to Crimea, but also take every part of Ukraine along the Dnieper River, including right up to the edge of Kiev. Those are the three scenarios laid out. And Steve, this looks so realistic to me. I have to believe that they're debating this in Brussels as well. And in the event of this kind of crisis, Steve, escalation is automatic. You'd have to put in major weapon systems on ready alert all along the frontier if the Russians are this heavily engaged.
I don't know what the political calculation of the Stratford military scenarios might be. My view is that's the last thing Putin and the Russian political elite would want. It's often asked, what does Putin want? I've said since we began to talk, and for this I've been attacked, but I'm 100% certain that what Putin wants is an end to the fighting, a stable Ukraine, a Ukraine not in NATO, and a Ukraine trading with Russia, as it always has, and with the West if it wants. But he wants the war ended. There's nothing in it for him. He has no motive. However, that said, there is grave concern in Moscow that if push comes to shove, NATO forces will enter Western Ukraine. Now, Crimea is part of Russia now. It was reunified or annexed in 2014, depending on how you look at it. So if you're in charge of contingency planning, and you're a general, obviously you're going to fortify Crimea. It's your forward region. As though, imagine that suddenly we thought the Mexicans were going to invade the United States, we would fortify Texas. So these plans have probably been drawn up. But there's a flaw here. There's a misunderstanding. There is no Donbass landline from Mariupol to Crimea. It's true that Crimea is a peninsula, and it's cut off from mainland Russia. The Russians are now building, I think it's very expensive, about $4 billion, and it's probably going to take another year and a half, a bridge.
Right.
To Crimea from the Russian, from Krasnodarsk, I think, from the mainland. That will be their landline. But in the meantime, to back up a bit, I don't care what for Victoria Nuland and General Breedlove say. There's been no massive Russian troop invasion of eastern Ukraine. Most of the fighting there is done by people who are citizens of the Donbass. If the political leadership of the Donbass wants Mariupol, it's not because there's a land line or land mass to Crimea. There isn't in the Donbass. They would have to go through other parts of Ukraine.
Right. It's very far away from Crimea, Mariupol. And,
well, not only that, but they would have to go through regions of Crimea that are not hospitable
right.
to eastern Ukraine. So this would really require the Russian army would have to do it. The political leadership of Donbass wants Mariupol. It doesn't mean it's going to take it, but it wants it for two reasons. Mariupol is the second largest city of the Donbass. So if they are the government of Donbass, but Kiev governs Mariupol, that's a political anomaly they don't like. They want to govern Mariupol as well. The other reason is it's a major seaport. And that's as good as a landline if they're going to be supplied by Russia, because it's a deep seaport, a very good one, and their supply problem would be relieved. But here's what we come back to, I think. I'm sure Stratford's thought all this out. They're very smart people. And these scenarios on paper are certainly plausible. But remember, generals are paid to do contingency plans. I understand that we have a contingency plan if we're invaded by Mars, what we're going to do. I mean, you're supposed to think about everything. But the Russian political leadership, having watched what happened in 2014, when you say Brzezinski testified, could you imagine Putin did this? I'm sure they sit in the Kremlin and say, could you imagine the Americans did this? that they are obliged, as would be any national security leadership, to make contingency plans. But I shouldn't say I'm absolutely convinced, but it's my judgment that Putin would not act on any of these very aggressive military scenarios unless he felt there was a major provocation that represented a threat to the Russian state. That's why they took Crimea. And it's over as far as they're concerned if Minsk II settles the issue of eastern Ukraine. It's a big if. But if you sit in Moscow today, John, and you listen to the American newspapers, you listen to the officials of the Obama administration, you listen to McCain and the Democratic Party demanding that we now fight Russia in Ukraine, obviously you're worried there might be an invasion of Crimea. And so you fortify, and you fortify the Black Sea, and you get ready. And I don't care who's sitting in the Kremlin, whether it's Putin or the oligarch in exile, Khodorkovsky, any leader of Russia would have to do this, just as we would expect an American president to do this. So that's where we're at. That's where the danger is.
My concern, Steve, is history says that escalation doesn't have a way of turning itself off. It becomes a frenzy along the frontier, so that you mentioned these generals, their jobs are to prepare worst case scenario. Yeah. Then you build up capabilities. And when one side sees the other capability going higher, it raises its point of view. And so pretty soon the generals are in command of the frontier, not the politicians. I think that's what Stratfor is pointing to. And
I
think that's what General Breedlove is anticipating, if not in place. Because we see photographs all the time now of American equipment that's been deployed in the Baltic states. Major American weapon systems parked there. Now, the Russians would spend an afternoon defeating it. But certainly, if they did defeat that, that's defeating the American army, which means that there'd be a follow-on. This would not be the end of the battle.
And even worse, we're debating, Washington's debating, whether to send $1 billion worth of American sophisticated weapons to Kiev for 3 years. That's a lot of weapons. But meanwhile, weapons are going to Kiev from the West, whether they're going from the United Arab Emirate or through Poland.
Or Georgia.
We know weapons are going there, and we also know, because it's not a secret, that something like 700 American paratroopers are already in Ukraine. We talked about this before. There are American soldiers in Ukraine, John. So what happens if somebody wants to provoke a war between Russia and the United States? They bring out the snipers, they kill 10 Americans, and then Obama has to do something. One other thing. We don't talk about it very much here, except when we accuse Russia of lying. But in Europe, the military factor is seen in conjunction with what's called the media war. Many people remark, and possibly it's because of the new technology, social media, information is instantaneous and widespread now in a way it wasn't before. But the incredibly false information that's flowing out of so many capitals, it's so much and it's so fast, it can't be fact-checked, so to speak. So it becomes part of this war atmosphere, along with these generals, as you say, doing these contingency plans. I, at the moment, am almost as worried about this media war. When I hear officials of the Obama administration testifying under oath to Congress about things I know not to be true, I don't know if they know it's not true. They may be testifying on bad briefings and in good faith, but they just aren't true, and the next day they're in the newspaper as facts. And the same thing's happening in Moscow, and the same thing's happening in Kiev, and the same thing's happening in Brussels. This is also an escalator toward war.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, returned from Europe, but he's also returned from Moscow. And when we come back, Remember the Cold War, the Soviet state, the construction of a nuclear weapon system that would defeat the United States in the event of attack. The Russian people, the Soviets, were led to believe that the Americans were their enemies. There's reporting within these last days that right now America is more unpopular, more despised in 2015 than it ever was when the nuclear forces faced off against each other. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, and I tell a story of the Cold War. It's fabulous. You'll think I've made it up from Dr. Strangelove. It's a system called the Dead Hand. It was constructed in the 1980s when the Cold War was at its worst, during Ronald Reagan's administration, first and second administration. There were several leaders of Russia, the Soviet state at the time, died or passed on or were ineffective. And then Mr. Gorbachev came forward, miraculously, and with Mr. Reagan, led their way out of the Dead Hand. What was it? It was a system we didn't learn about until the 1990s. Then, in the event of nuclear war, there was a sealed room or bubble, not run by robots, but by human beings, that would sit there, these human beings, in this room. And if three lights went off, they would launch missiles that had launch codes left, east, north, west, in the Soviet state, and those missiles flying over the pre-programmed launch sites of the Soviet state, presuming decapitation and the orders hadn't been given out, would launch the end of the world. That's right. The Soviets constructed in 1985 a way to end the world. In Dr. Strangelove, they called it the Doomsday Machine, and there was much screaming at the end of that very tragic comedy. Why didn't you tell us it existed? What's the point of having a doomsday machine if you don't tell us? Well, the Soviets didn't tell us it existed. We learned about it after the end of the Soviet state. But here we are in 2015 with Ukraine crisis and presenting to us, and the professor is now coming back from Moscow. And I have a story in the Washington Post pointing to polling done in Russia that 80% of Russians now hold negative views of the United States. This is far higher than during the worst of the Cold War, when many Russians believed that America was the way out, that we were the land of delivery, of transparency, of success. Steve, is it like this on the streets now? Are Americans stared at?
I didn't sense it. I was there only 3 days, but because I've been going to Russia for so many years, they were intense 3 days. I want to say something about this figure. 80% of Russians now have a negative attitude toward America. This is like quadruple what it was 8, 9, 10 years ago. It's explained in the West by Russian propaganda. And it's true that national network Russian television is doing a lot of anti-American broadcasting, a lot of conspiracy theories. It's also true that, as in the United States, about 80% of Russians get their news from television still. Our young people go to social media, but still it's nearly 80%. But this is a demeaning attitude toward ordinary Russians. It presents them as zombies, as though they can't think for themselves. They only react to the stimuli of state propaganda. And based on my 35, nearly 40 years of visiting and living in Russia, this isn't true. Russians just don't like what we've been doing toward Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. This began back in the 1990s. I'm not going to walk us through all the different episodes, but let's just take the most obvious. Russians don't need state television to tell them that NATO has crept from Berlin to Russia's borders, that the three Baltic countries, where Russians often spent their summer vacations, are now NATO countries. They go there, they see the flags fly. They don't like this, and they think it's aggressive and it's menacing. And Ukraine is like a cousin to Russia. And they see what's happening in Ukraine, and they do blame Americans, not because that's what Soviet state television tells them, but because they have so many relatives in Ukraine who say the same thing. So this anti-Americanism is not first and foremost a product of Russian propaganda, though that abets and enhances it. It's a product of our policy toward Russia for nearly 20 years, which raises a question. Has this been a wise policy? Do we really want to alienate the Russian people? Because after all, after Putin, there'll be a new Russian government. And even if it's authoritarian, it will base its policies on what it thinks is popular. And if being part of the West and being friendly with America is no longer popular, the new government will not pursue that kind of policy. So part of the problem with this crisis today is we blame it all on Russia, 100%. Not one major newspaper, not one major American official has said, did we do anything wrong during the last 20 years? Not one. So there's no rethinking. We press on, blind to our own fallacies, making the situation worse. But when we hear stories that, oh, Russians have been brainwashed by their media, we give ourselves a pass. We say our policy contributed nothing to the way Russians have come to feel about that. I'll add one footnote. I lived in Moscow a lot from 1976 until they took my visa away in 1982. It was a very bad period in the Cold War. Never once, not one time, did I meet anyone, whether an ordinary citizen, an official, or a dissident. Well, I met some fascists. They were anti-American. But I never met anybody, even though the official Soviet ideology was anti-American, I never met any people who were anti-American. Now you meet them everywhere you turn, and communism is gone. So Americans who think about this ought to be able to add up 2 and 2 and get 4 and not get 6 or some other number the way our media is presenting this development in Russia.
We have about a minute, Steve. Did you see the deprivation on the streets of Moscow because of the sanctions? Did you see people pulling back?
No. I shopped a bit while I was there. I asked my friends. Food prices, which are the most severely affected, are up about 15%. Mm-hmm. Sugar, starchy goods, baking goods is up. The state's got enough reserves to cushion that. Could get worse. But, you know, the odd thing is, John, and this is another broadcast, I guess, that the Russian economy, there's some positive signs. The market looks good to foreign investors. They're getting credits in the East. They're switching their market.
The Europeans don't want any more sanctions. They made it very clear.
No, the Europeans want to end it. But remember, there are American sanctions and there are Europeans.
Right, I understand.
The Europeans could end theirs. We'll keep ours. But Russians are going to pay a price, obviously. It's going to be painful. The main problem is going to be in Russia. There's going to be no investment in new infrastructure. There's just no money.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus, just returned from, as he told you, he was in Germany, was in Brussels, in Belgium, in Germany, and in Moscow. We will continue another week. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show.